So I keep hoping that Atmanirbhar Bharat will actually walk the talk and, you know, help small craftspeople get access to raw material that is so far, you know, coming from abroad.
Welcome to Season 2 of India Book Podcast. India Book is a podcast that uses literature as a lever to bring up multiple fields of India. This is a perfect podcast for you if you're a bibliophile looking for your next read, or if you're a trivia junkie and be interested in learning more about things. It's also perfect for you if you're just interested in learning more about India as a nation. Every episode focuses on a different theme and takes place via a conversation between the host and the celebratory author that we have on the show. I am Ayushi Mona, your host on India Book.
In certain villages of West Bengal, the rural economy is driven by rather unusual professions. One cluster of craftsmen make wigs, another make lights, polo balls, boats, shuttlecocks, and even a pair of jeans. In the Shadows, Unknown Craftsmen of Bengal chronicles the story of six such rural areas. It takes a close look at the lives, crafts, and futures of the people who live here. Following the original process, which has been passed down generations, these craftsmen keep alive old family traditions. Their efforts give them a basic livelihood and in some cases a little more. In the Shadows celebrates the indomitable spirit of enterprises of a rural craftsman. Join me on India Booked with author Payal Mohanka as we dive deep into this story. Hi everyone, I'm Ayushi Mona and you're listening to India Booked, a podcast where we lean into the idea of India through books written by Indian authors or featuring the different shades of our subcontinent. Today I'm joined by Payal. Payal Mohanka started her career as a journalist with the Illustrated Weekly of India, and she spent over a decade with the magazine covering a wide range of subjects. She's written for Reddit.com and The Roundtable. She was also awarded the prestigious Press Fellowship to Wolfson College, Cambridge, moved to broadcast journalism. Payal, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and for writing this book and being here to tell us a little more about it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
So, Payal, the first question that I have to ask you is that there are very few journalists who go back to, you know, source material for a story that they've done, right? And you covered this for the BBC, if I'm not mistaken, for a series of capsule-like episodes. And you've obviously done hundreds of stories in your career. So what made you go back to this and realize that this story, among the many, many untold stories of India, needed to be told again?
Actually, as a Calcuttan, I didn't even know these places existed. So when I first stepped out into these rural areas, only because I was working on this program called the India Business Report, it was telecast every Sunday on BBC. And I was working with TV18. They had this program. And every week I was supposed to file a dynamic business story, and that was very hard from Calcutta in the mid-90s. So I had heard about these rural clusters, and when I ventured out there, I was quite taken aback because, you know, I've lived in Calcutta all my life and I've never known these places existed. And so it really struck a chord with me. And, you know, everywhere you went, the craft was different. The whole rural economy was hinged on one quaint activity, but that spirit was the same everywhere, that indomitable spirit. And I just wanted to salute that spirit of enterprise among rural craftspeople. And that's when I thought that, okay, when I have time, I'll come back and I'll do this in a more detailed form, you know, sort of chronicle their lives, their craft in a more tangible form, and I'd try and work on a book. And that's exactly when the TV18 shut shop in Calcutta. I had time on my hands. So I was keen on two documentaries and this book. And that's how this happened.
Wow. And for me, I think when I started reading the book and for everyone listening to the podcast, right? The narrative of these untold stories is something which, you know, there's also a very dominant sort of narrative around crafts. Right? That crafts are almost always about, you know, and when the average urban Indian perceives of craft work, they always have this, okay, this Rajasthani sort of potli or this kind of like, you know, making a figurine or an idol.
More decorative stuff always.
Yes. Always decorative, always aesthetic, and then you read about somebody who's making polo balls with the kind of, I think, absolute surrender to the craft, right? And it makes one think, so how between these six narratives that you've picked up, Payal, did you decide that, you know, you are going to take the lens that you finally went with? You've covered their lives extensively, but you've done it from a place of absolute empathy and telling it as is. How did you sort of resist the temptation to not make it about, hey, these are all just marginalized craftsmen, and then the narrative was very different. These were very empowering, almost stories of business people. Even when, I think when you mentioned that business was thin, you've gone about it in a way where, you know, I think the empathy that you had shines through the book. What was your experience of meeting these people? How did you decide? What is the gaze that you wanted to chronicle these stories with?
For this very program, we did probably over 20 such stories. So, you know, even in Bankura district, we did Baluchery, we did Dokra, that's a metal craft, we did terracotta. And those were all the more traditional, you know, when you think of craft, you think of these decorative things. So when I'd gone to these villages, I found that there was nothing available on Google at that point on any of these. There was no research material there at all. And that's when it struck me that, they are like not traditional craft. They've all, they've got this one activity and the entire rural community's economy is hinged on this one craft. So I was very fascinated, the very fact that it was the same, like whether you're doing something decorative or you're doing something like, it could be so dull and boring, like a polo ball or a shuttlecock, but the kind of passion that goes into it, the kind of labor that goes into it, and how that's everything for them. It's their whole world. Like just recently, I had gone back to the polo ball village and I was talking to the young son of the largest polo ball manufacturer. And he must have been about 11 when I last met him. And now he's about 27. And, you know, he was just telling me that, you know, this was my first toy. And now today, that's his father and his grandfather's livelihood it's been, you know. So for them, it's not just another business. There's so much passion that goes into it. It's sort of very consuming, and I think that's what really struck a chord with me, that just it was something very fascinating and something that I wasn't even aware that this was happening just a couple of hours away from Calcutta.
While you also have, I think, beautiful pictures, right? And Leena Kejriwal was a photographer.
She's really brought the world alive with her evocative photographs.
I wanted to ask you, when you set about, you know, to photograph these journeys, how was that like? Or what were the reactions from the craftsmen, right? Because again, just like aesthetic or decorative crafts, these aren't craftsmen who are used to frequent inquiries, right, from the world of like media and
absolutely.
Content.
So what Yeah, it's a very niche audience that they are always catering to. And I don't, you know, like you would go and you would watch a potter and you would actually take detailed shots of him with his pottery. But here it was, as you say, totally different. And I thought of Leena Kejriwal. I'd seen one of her exhibitions and I found so much poetry in her pictures that I requested her to come with me. And then once she came and saw one of these villages, she was really, really pretty keen to be part of this. And they were very, very accommodating, the craftspeople. Also, I had already been there before with a television crew. And there we had done it for a business program, so a business story. It was a different perspective probably. And this time when I went back, they were very, very accommodative because they were familiar. I had already been there. And, you know, they let you in and they let you, you know, do your work. They actually put aside their work for a few hours so that they can answer all your questions and cooperate with you. But very amiable.
And out of all the six stories that you wrote, if, and this is a scenario, but if you had to write, say, a full-fledged book on one of these six, which one would you like to go back to?
I think it'll be The Lightmakers. Maybe there's a lot of material also there because, you know, even today they're facing a lot of problems because when I did the book, all their raw material were indigenous. And in the last few years, everything from their, you know, these LED bulbs, the wires, the circuits, the PVC paper, everything comes from China. And that really bothers them because they've not been able to get any support from the government in terms of helping them to set up, you know, production facilities for their own raw material. So I keep hoping that Atmanirbhar Bharat will actually walk the talk and, you know, help small craftspeople get access to raw material that is so far, you know, coming from abroad. You know, it's a magical place. Like, you know, you watch them work and when they're lighting up and you see those shots of all those twinkling lights come alive. It's very fascinating. And the very fact that there's one man who's quite an icon in Chandanagar, Sridhar Das, he spawned this entire industry. And as a child, you know, his story goes back when he was just a child, fascinated with torches and lights and bulbs. And much against his parents' will, he wanted to make a career out of this. And he actually left home at 17 to find a partner and set up a roadside electrical shop. So, you know, he's the one who spawned the entire industry. And when he set up his company, he had 200 people working with him. And taking inspiration from him, within this 3 square kilometer radius, there are more than 200 units doing the same work. So it's a very fascinating story there because I think the scale is also much larger. And then, you know, we all see all their work. It's also against, like, it comes more on the decorative thing. When you see the final results, like especially being in Bengal and you see the pujas, all the lights here come from Chandanagar. And the entire city is set, like lit up like a fairyland.
And out of all of these, you know, the narratives, right? Also, I think one part that really stayed with me after having read the book was, remember that portion pile where you've written about how they've used lighting to bring and juxtapose some of these social evils that we see, right? So how somebody gets treated in a private hospital surrounded by doctors and nurses versus somebody at a government hospital surrounded by cattle and stray animals. And, you know, they've used lighting to bring that out. And then, you know, I mean, of course, I was reading the book and immensely enjoying it. But when I read that section, I just paused for a moment. And, you know, then I visualized it in my head and I thought, wow, just the imagery of that moment and them making a point like that. And we see all of this, you know, sand art, and there will be an original, you know, tweet about it and, you know, art for social change. But this is actually art for social change.
Yeah, that's something you see every year in Bengal during the pujas. They will always have some topical theme. I remember the year Princess Diana died or even Mother Teresa. You know, they will always have whatever's happened most recently featured in their tabloids. This is always there. Like anything topical is always, always illuminated with lights and displayed.
Yeah, I thought, you know, when I was reading it, I thought, ki, you know, just the fact that there is almost a perception, you know, between the haves and the have-nots, you know, that the haves almost separate the fact that the have-nots are sensitive to their experiences, you know, in a way for somebody to see a queue outside a government hospital who can afford a private hospital, they're just thinking in their head that haan yahan pe to line rehti hum isme nahi jayenge. But for somebody who's actually the person queuing there, also given the resources and given the time and given the talent, has a narrative that, you know, they want to express, which to me, even though all of these crafts are commercial crafts, right, polo balls, boat making, But I thought that even with commercial crafts, there is such an aspect of storytelling that all of these craftsmen still carry within. The other narrative that I really enjoyed was obviously the wig makers. And I think the wig makers was, it's the chapter you start with Payal. So why did you start with the wig makers?
You know, it was just a coincidence, actually. We just began shooting there first and then it just sort of fitted in. I said, okay, let's, we just stuck to that. There was no real reason for that, actually.
You know, when I was reading the book, I was constantly thinking that, you know, what, is there an order to this, right?
For this series, it was the first village that we had ventured into.
I thought for a moment to myself, right, that, oh, is it because jeans are the most commercial or is it because wigs are like that? But now it makes complete sense. I also really enjoyed the portion of the wig story where the children come together and there's a lovely, lovely, lovely picture, you know, with them wearing blonde wigs and pink wigs in the middle of a village.
In all the villages we find when you maybe go to shoot, they just love the camera, and this photographer was also very, very managed to get them in the right mood, and very playfully they'll be putting on all these colorful wigs which are made for mannequins. So whether it's pink, blonde, brunette, red, they're quite happy to be our models for the photograph.
Give me a second. I'm trying to recollect the name of this individual. Yes, so Mujibur, right? And Mujibur is one of the, for people listening to the podcast, one of the, I wouldn't say characters, one of the people that Payal touches upon. And, you know, with Mujibur, there is this aspect, right, where he has a what you call a bohemian whim, and he shaves his head and he walks around the village with a flaming orange wig. And you know, Payal, that was also so interesting for me, because as somebody who's predominantly always lived in an urban area throughout her life, and I think for most of us now, right, who obviously live and consume whatever culture that we do is very, very urban, right? The lens that we live through. The fact that when we think of farmers, we always think of them as either starving or tilling the soil or, you know, working in the fields. And reading the book also gave me a sense of multiple subcultures, right, that exist. So there is obviously farming activity.
Television, and now with social media, a lot has seeped in there. So they are also exposed to things which they hadn't been earlier. So this sense of fun for him to shave his head and walk around the village for a month, donning a flaming orange wig with black at the edges. Yeah, I remember him saying that.
What do you think, Payal, when you were doing your research, etc., in terms of technology making the lives of these craftsmen better? You obviously covered this in a lot in detail. You know, when you talk about how one of the craftsmen has purchased a computer for his son and all of that. Yes. But across these six stories, how did you see how technology and communications has affected their livelihoods?
No, I think still it's very, very at a very nascent stage, except for a few who are becoming quite savvy. Like the polo ball maker, he would be in touch with his customers on the comp, but that wasn't holding true for many others. Like for them, it's all very local. Even the Bolagar boat makers, all the customers come there and take the boats from them. So they, even the jeans, it's still at a very nascent stage. You know, because their raw material is available locally, and then everything is shipped and sent to the wholesale markets. So not still pretty much untouched, I would say. It still has a long way to go. Actually, they don't really get any support from outside. It's whatever they can manage within.
Also, for some of these craftsmen, right, when you were writing about their journey, you've touched upon places where they're comparatively commercially prosperous, you know, but obviously most of them are struggling or dwindling or struggling with margins or production. How do you see, as somebody writing about this, the lens for the really micro and small business people and craftspeople of India. What was that as an experience for you like?
It was like they've never had any formal training. They haven't been to business school. It's just native intelligence and these homespun skills. And through generations, they are being passed on. And they do struggle a lot with a lot of things. For instance, you know, raw material procurement, like the shuttlecock village is totally dependent on duck feathers from Bangladesh. And through Corona, they suffered hugely because you know, everything had come to a standstill. So they didn't have any raw material to work with. And so it is, they have their own difficulties, but it's amazing how that grit and that determination helps them to tide over everything. And that's why at the end of it, you know, you just want to salute that spirit of enterprise amongst these craftsmen. That even when we spoke to them after, during Corona, I remember I had spoken to them, and it wasn't like they weren't defeated. They were just willing to, like, they knew this is not going to go on forever, and once it blows over, they'll be back to normal. And now, for instance, the exports, again, they can get their raw material from Bangladesh, but then they have GST issues, which they are grappling with. So actually, they would really, it would be really good if the local administration in these areas will actually take a keen look at their issues and just help solve some of them. Because, you know, that's what they need. There's this need for middlemen between them and the government, so that their queries get an answer. Otherwise, they're just grappling in the dark themselves and sort of finding a solution to their own problems.
And from, like, I think even in the wig story, I remember that, you know, this is something that's not changed over the years at all. Because I do remember that there's this portion where you talk about, I think this is the 70s or the 80s, where a cyclone sort of rips through the houses. And then, you know, gradually everyone builds concrete houses and all of that. And then, you know, like there's this wave of COVID, and then it's really every craftsman for themselves, and there is no system or structure. In fact, I also do remember, and I wanted to ask you this, about the interconnectedness between these craftspeople and the middlemen that they deal with. Because as you were saying, and as is very, very evident in the book, is that while one of these six stories is probably the person being really connected to the external world, by and large, these craftsmen still are dependent on a nexus of people to get to their end customer.
Actually, the minute they get a little successful, they manage to get that direct entry. For instance, the polo ball maker, he does it all himself because he knows who needs his stuff. And he's very, actually, it also depends a lot of, some of them are more ambitious than others. For instance, the polo ball maker. Now, from bamboo balls, he's moved to hardwood balls. Now he's trying to do what Argentina is producing and what the world, what polo ball players all over the world use, the plastic balls. So he feels that he could easily do this, but it just somewhat chemical that they have, which he doesn't. So he was saying that, you know, now he's actually getting research and development organized so that done so that they can get their hands on a similar chemical. Once he gets that, he knows the procedure, because the team from Argentina came to his village in Diolpur in Howrah district and actually took videos of his people making those balls with hardwood. So they're using the same process. So plastic balls are maybe the same process. And again, now he's got a machine. When I went did the book, he didn't have any machine doing that. Everything was done by hand. So there is development, but it's slow. And it's mostly slow because they don't have any external help. It's all happening just organically and from within. So those who are a little more ambitious, actually, they can do a little better because you know, his son is now with him and he's really keen to take this forward. And he's quite determined to also start producing plastic balls because the world is using plastic for all polo ball players except for cycle polo and in areas of the northeast. So he's sending his hardwood balls there, but yeah, it all differs on the person behind the business also. I see.
Yes, one other you know, theme that I found going through the book was jatra or the local theater. And I found it so interesting that you touched upon it in the chapter on the boat makers. You touched upon it in the chapter in the wig makers and so on. Because it seems like the local theater production really was, whether it's the lights, the wigs, you know, there are customers to this. And to me, this was so interesting because, again, we never really think of it. We just think of, okay, this is a local theater group, and now people are, say, watching YouTube videos on their phone or OTT or whatever it is, right? Progressively, even going beyond satellite TV. But the fact that local art can actually foster so much work in the community, can give business, was very interesting to me. And I think that's one of the second order effects or spillover effects that people don't really talk about from local arts and crafts dying, because it almost seemed as if so many of these revolved around local needs, and when the local needs sort of suffered or they supplemented it with additional needs, especially in the case of, I think, wigs, lights, you know, that portion of the chapters. So that, again, was interesting to me. What did you discover really about, Payal, about how the locals consume from this business and even within Bengal, right? How is this happening? I think apart from, I think, the polo example.
Like in the rural areas, this local theatre, Jatra, plays a very important part. That's one of the chief sources of entertainment. Now, of course, in the last few years, you'll see a shift with most people having mobile phones. So there's more, there are different avenues of entertainment. But when you did this book, that time probably that was the most important entertainment for most rural areas. And then, you know, it's that sense of community, because everybody gathers together, you know, watching something. And of course, people like the wig makers are even supplying things there. So that makes, you know, it's a different relationship altogether for them.
Yes. But it's been, I think, personally, a wonderful journey, you know, to read about these narratives. I read the book in one sitting. It's a, for everyone listening to the podcast, it's a very easy to consume book. Let me just put it that way. It's just a little over 100 pages. There are wonderful images that, you know, really help you experience a part of craftsmanship in India that we don't always touch upon. And while, of course, Payal has touched upon their hardships, the view is not exploitative. It comes across almost as if, you know, you were visiting a long-lost family member and got a gaze into their life maybe 10, 20 years apart. So thank you, Payal, I think, for writing this book and for going back to your original interview.
When you go back and you see there's been development. So that's like, I visited almost 15 years later. I went to the Polo Ball Village just last week, in fact. And, you know, it feels so much better when you see that things have improved. Now they have machines, their scale is getting larger, their ambitions are also soaring. So that's also very nice, because 15 years ago, it almost seemed like Diolpur wouldn't have that kind of prominent place on the world polo map anymore. Because it looked like each time a craftsman dies, at one, the chapter ends with this craft moves a step closer to extinction. But it's so nice the way they've turned things around.
Absolutely. It was, I think, just inspiring and humbling to read this all together at the same time. Payal, thank you for writing In the Shadows. For everyone listening to the podcast, In the Shadows, Unknown Craftsmen of Bengal, is a publication by Neogi Books. You can find it on their website, Amazon, Flipkart, independent bookstores. Do read the book. Do specially gift the book, I feel, to, you know, people who are interested in culture, people who are interested in human stories, and people who want to see, I think, a glimpse of the entrepreneurship that India indigenously has produced for so many years. Payal, it was a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you for doing this.
Did you like this episode? Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and on Instagram, where we are available as India Book Podcast. Also, if you'd like to recommend changes that we should make to the show or some author that we should definitely have, feel free to leave us feedback, recommendations, etc. on indiabookpodcast@gmail.com. If you love listening to the show, do not forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever it is that you get your podcast fix from.